Well, good afternoon. As our first order of business, we have a special guest, Dieter van Melkebeck, is that close? Who's a faculty member who's going to be teaching this summer. He's going to be teaching 577. As you might also know, the UW has a football coach and a basketball coach, and it turns out we also have a programming team coach, and that is Dieter. So he doesn't quite make as much as the football or basketball guys, I think. But actually, as he may get into this a little bit, he's been at least as successful as they have been, and perhaps even a tad more so. And it happens that Epic has been very supportive of our teams and so on, and he'll acknowledge that and let you in on all that, and maybe even let you see a couple of the questions. If you're on the programming team, you have to solve programs, and we'll see if his are harder than mine. So he's going to just talk a little bit about 10 or 15 minutes about what to expect over the summer and also a little bit about perhaps the programming team. So I'll turn it over to him.
All right. Thanks, Charlie, for the nice introduction, and welcome, everyone. So I think I'll just use like 10, 15 minutes to give a brief overview of what the course I'll be teaching here in summer will be. So it's 577, Introduction to Algorithms. The learning objectives of the course are twofold. One is to teach you techniques for designing correct and efficient algorithms. So we'll go over several programming paradigms that are very useful in several settings. And then also tools to reason about those aspects, to reason about the correctness of programs, to reason about the efficiency of programs. And the specific topics we'll discuss are the following. So I'm going to express them, list them by week. So the course will be 11 weeks, 10 weeks of lectures, and then 1 week for review and the exam. So we'll start, rather basically with material that you've probably seen, maybe not in the same depth, but at least you should be familiar with if you've taken 367. So one is program correctness, reason about program correctness using program loop invariants, induction arguments, and then we'll start with the first programming paradigm, which is divide and conquer, which is presumably something you're familiar with. So one example of a problem that you, or algorithm that works this way, is the merge sort algorithm, where you want to sort a sequence, and the way you do it is by breaking up the sequence into two parts, recursively sort those, and then merge the two sorted sequences. Okay, that gives you an algorithm that running time will be like order n log n, where n is the number of elements. So I presume you've seen this before. If not, we'll go through this in detail. That will be one of the first examples of algorithms we cover. The next, probably also more of a revision, is graph primitives, very simple procedures, basic procedures that work on graphs, like depth first search, breadth first search. Another such problem is the shortest path problem. You're given a graph with edge weights, and you want to find two vertices, S and T. You want to find a shortest path from S to T. That's a problem that actually can be solved using a greedy approach, and that's the next topic we'll talk about. Greedy algorithms, so these are algorithms that try to solve some typically optimization problem where you have a system that consists of many components, and each of these components you can set in various ways, and a greedy approach is going to look very locally and set the components optimally just locally, and then the hope is that that will give you an overall optimum. This is an approach, if it works, it works very well. Typically, it gives very quick algorithms. But convincing yourself that it actually works, that it always gives the correct answer, that's the difficult part here. One example of a problem that we'll cover there is designing Hoffman codes, which are used for in fax systems, for example, to transmit data. So here you're given some symbols you want to submit, like, for example, E, A, etc., and you're given some frequency with which these symbols appear. So here E appears four times, A four times, N twice, etc. And you want to design a code, a variable length code, such that the expected encoding length is as short as possible. And that's something you can do using a greedy approach. The next technique, and that's probably, so greedy is probably something you've seen somewhere already before too. The next technique is called dynamic programming. That's probably new for most of you, and that's, I would say, the core technique in this course. That's a technique that's very useful in a lot of problems that have to deal with computational biology or with word processing. So, for example, sequence alignment. So, I mean, it's a little bit small here, but so this is a DNA sequence or various DNA sequences, and we want to line them up in an ideal, as good as we can, in order to find, well, areas that have similar, that code for similar properties or things like this. So typically these matches are not perfect. We may skip some symbols, maybe there are some mismatches, and we want to line them up in a way that's as good as possible. So that's, then there's one more paradigm. This is the paradigm, the underlying paradigm is more that of reductions, reducing some problems to another in an efficient way. And we'll apply this in particular to network flow problems. So that's an important problem in its own right. But there's also several other problems, like, for example, matching problems. So if you have machines and jobs, some machines can be executed on can execute some jobs, but not all. And we want to assign jobs to machines such that they're compatible, and we can execute as many jobs as possible. That's called a matching problem. And actually, you can reduce it. You can express it as a network flow problem. That would be an example of a non-trivial reduction. So these are the programming paradigms that we'll talk about in the course. There's one more aspect that we'll address at the end, which is NP-completeness, which deals with problems that for which we do not know of efficient algorithms. We're going to only spend 1 week on this, the last week, but it's something that's still, it's important for you to know. It's actually my area of research. It's very close to it, at least. And this deals with problems, for example, like the traveling salesperson problem you may have heard of. You're given a bunch of cities and costs to travel between cities, and you want to find a tour that visits every city and has minimal cost. That's a problem for which we don't know of an efficient algorithm, and it's actually equivalent to a whole class of problems for which we would really like to have an efficient algorithm, but we don't know yet. And that's, I mean, if you're designing other algorithms, this is a good piece of information, good thing to know. And then, as I said, the last week will be just a review and exam. So that's the plan. Prerequisites for this course. So one is you should have some programming experience, like in particular 367. I presume most, if not all of you, have taken it. I will talk to the instructor from 367, who taught 367 in summer here, so that I know exactly what was covered here, and I'll presume this, and we will review some of these things very quickly at the beginning. But that's you should have some programming experience also. I may probably will assign some smaller programming problems rather than just design and analysis problems. For that, you can use Java or C or C++. Another prerequisite for the normal offering of this course is 240, which is Introduction to Discrete Mathematics. That's something I essentially not assume this here, so I plan to hand out some calibration questionnaire to the ones who sign up for the course so that I know what your background is, and we'll fill in those gaps then in the first few lectures. Yeah, so that's the plan. Textbook, in case you want to already get it, it's this book, Algorithm Design by Klanbrook and Tardos. It's I think it's a very nice one. It focuses very much on graphs. It's very graph-oriented. There should be secondhand copies around too, because this is a textbook that we're using normally for the course. Logistics. So the class will run for 11 weeks. The first lecture will be on Monday, June the 8th, and then we'll run till the week of August 17. So the lectures will be same time slot as this one, but on Mondays. There will be also review sessions, we haven't decided yet what the time is, because we're still looking for the person, the TA, who will run those review sessions, probably Tuesday or Wednesday evenings. And then office hours, yes, they also still to be determined. I would like, if you're want to take it, I would like to suggest you to register soon so that we know how many people are taking it. I think registration is already open. So that's about what I wanted to say about the course. Then, as Charlie announced, I'm going to say something also about this programming competition, International Collegiate Programming Contest, which is kind of the mother of all programming contests. This year is the 39th edition of it. It's a competition, it's a worldwide competition. Almost 40,000 students, undergraduates and beginning graduate students participate in it. And it's relevant to this course and to this offering in particular, first because the material of 577 is central to that competition. And this actually works both ways, because I'll actually steal some of the problems that have been used in the past, not the most challenging ones, but some of them as inspiration for homework problems, or maybe as homework problems just as such too. And the other connection is, yes, that UW-Madison has been participating in this for a while, and recently it's been supported by EPIC in two ways. One, so this is a competition that consists of two layers. The first layer is a regional one, and so EPIC, there is the regional, EPIC is a regional site for our region since a few years. And then at the top team from the region can advance to the world finals. This year they will be in Morocco in a few weeks. And EPIC also provides the funding for the team to attend the world finals. And one thing that I'm proud of is that UW-Madison is actually the only North American school that has advanced to the world finals in each of the past 14 years. And 14 years is how long we've been doing this. So we've been advancing to the world finals every year. So that's about what I had in mind. If you have any questions, I'll be happy to answer them. Yes. It's more focused on, coming up with the algorithm, right? So coming up with the basic idea of the algorithm. Implementation is then the next step, but often implementation takes a lot of additional work. And that's something you've presumably seen in other courses. There will be some, as I said, some programming components, like maybe, maybe a quarter of the work or something will be on programming. It's more on the, I would view the design, coming up with correct and efficient algorithms, as the core topic, but that entails, being able to analyze them too, right? To reason about them, as I mentioned.
You mentioned introduction to
street math.
So I'm a little bit older.
Sure. So the things that are important for there is, one thing is this idea of reasoning by induction. That's something that we'll review in one of the first few lectures. This is important if you want to talk about programming, like loop invariance, for example, program correctness. That's where this comes in. Other things to analyze the efficiency of programs, like if you're big O notation. I presume this is something that you've done in 367 too, right? So that's what we need. Other than that, basic concept, like what is a graph. That's something that's typically covered in that course too. So those are the notions. Those are essentially the notions that we need. We don't need anything more fancy like counting. Counting permutations or that's things. Discrete probability theory, for example, is something that's also often covered in a discrete math course. That's something we won't need. So it's fairly. It's only a limited amount of material that we'll need from there. And as I said, we'll review it. I can also, if you want, there is a link if you go to my website. I actually have lecture notes for 240. You can take a look at there. For example, what we mean by program correctness, loop invariance, you can take a look there. Other questions? Right, so then, thanks again to Charlie.
Just a couple of things. One, I think it's probably the case 577 is being offered now this semester. So you could go to, are you teaching it?
No, this semester it's two, so Eric Bach and Debbie Joseph are teaching.
Are they teaching it similar to what you would?
Not quite, but the information from my last, so I taught it in fall. I have a website for this. Actually, I set up a website, a preliminary website for the summer offering too. I don't know. Did you guys get that URL? Or
it's on the EPIC wiki for the UWCS and EPIC.
Okay, perfect. Right. Yeah. So I can add material and links there too. The offering, more information like lecture, like how the lectures actually went in full. It's available on the web too, but it's behind a Moodle wall, so I'm not sure how to, I'll see whether I can do something about that.
Right. He should be able to make available exercises from previous semesters, so before you sign up, you know what you're getting into and the way of what he might assign. And since he's into algorithms, we have a little algorithm for you to put together. Namely, Dieter is planning to take a bus ride home, and he's leaving from, it's the staff parking 2?
B, I think that's...
Staff parking B. And if any of you are familiar, got to be more familiar than we are, you could perhaps point him in either the right or the wrong direction, depending on whether you want to be on his good side or bad. Because he made me promise that I would not make him sit through a couple of hours of my lecture. His lecture is more pleasant than mine. So if anybody would have some ideas on what the best way for him to get to that point is to pick up the bus, that'd be very helpful.
Go out down to the right. You want to go all the road past Andromeda, and Heaven. Those are kind of the road goes between those two. And if you go, it's going to kind of curve to the right. You see a walkway to the left. That'll take you right in front of Heaven. And that's where the bus is picked up.
Okay, great. Thanks a lot.
And does anybody know, where do they drop off?
I know.
Well, there's two. There's one at West Transfer, and then there's one downtown. I don't know about downtown.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, thanks a lot, and hope to see you in a few weeks and for summer course.
Okay, thank you, Dieter. And so we're going to be busy, busy, busy. We have 3 weeks left, the rest of today, and 2 lectures a week from today and 2 weeks from today. Also, again, on the wiki or not, we at ComSci got the announcement that the EPIC ComSci picnic is 2 weeks from yesterday. That is the first Monday in May. And at least on our end, they asked that we RSVP so they could determine how much free food to produce. And you're all invited, I know that for sure. Have you gotten contacts about where to sign up, or maybe you have to brown bag it or something? So what I'll do is when I get a chance, I'll email my contact here about what you have to do, but you're all welcome to come, meet your fellow students, meet some faculty, and I know you get great subsidized food, but there's nothing like free food, and the announcement was there was lobster tails, tenderloin medallions, high-class macaroni and cheese for vegetarians, and a nice vegetable plate for vegetarians, and desserts of various kinds and so on. So since you're helping pay for it, by all means, help and enjoy it all. So the first thing I want to do today is return the midterms, and you've all done very well. I think I'm very pleased with you in terms of preparing thoroughly and doing well, because I know many of you, particularly from the theoretical things about parsing and regular expressions and so on, had not seen it before. And for the most part, you mastered it. Here's the info. The median was 85, and even the people who got the lower grades, they were not so low that you're in a disaster situation. So what I'm going to do is hand back. The grades should be up, available already at Learn at UW, but I want to give the books back. The way things worked out, there were actually 3 separate sittings. There was a special sitting for very few people who couldn't make it either the first or the second regular sitting. So I want to give them back in the proper order because I have answer keys for the first sitting and the second sitting, but not for the special, since there was only 3 people. So you'll have to check with me directly. So Lynn McCormick, I saw her. Corwin Lawrence and Eric Gross. I did, by the way, try to make these exams about the same level of difficulty. Corwin?
Yep.
And that must be you.
Thanks. Cool.
We have handouts. Boy, do we have handouts. So they always tell me, welcome to the paperless society, and I'm certainly going to be welcome to see it when it comes. So since I have 2 separate answer keys for the 2 exams, I'll hand them back separately. So this would be from the first sitting, the earlier one. And see, Wesley Samotla. Yeah, sorry, I'm going to get that name right sooner or later. Tun Zhao. Kristen. Matt Owen. Karsten Quinlan. Carl Carlson. Dan Gerber. Tim Lohr. David Whalen. Dustin Carrolls with a K. Theodore Brenner. And Michael Kellum. Okay, that's all. Anybody from sitting one that I got? Always have this fear I'll lose somebody. Nicholas Moloch. See, Andrew, where is he? Andrew Maranovich. I thought you were the only Andrew in here, but you didn't know that. Yeah. Michael Santana. Blake Campbell. Michael White. Chris Viernig. Stuart Isaac. Stephen Lampier. Brian Baker. Brian Calippi. Blaze Norton Wisla. Denzel Showers. Would you believe somebody in a Showers family, not him, actually named their daughter April Showers? Boy, talk about having reason for revenge on your parents. Orion Smith. Junan Begawala. I always mess that up. Sorry about that. Not here. Quan Yin, Y-I-N. Dan Yogurst. Malcolm Reed. Josh Shansar. See Ali Kator. Nick Schober. Rob Owen. Michael Hudson. Is a couple of days going to be enough to finish off? Okay, cool. Tim Gieselman. Trisha Pearley. Brandon Frank. Dustin Maiden. Eugene Hyun, H-Y-U-N. Emma Schultz. Trey Peck. Pick, I'm sorry. Lorian Drager. Yeah. Sam Felt. No, you're not Sam Felt. Mr. Posner. Grant Gentoff Johnson. Patrick Robichaud. Derek Thompson. Clark Downham. Luke Matthews. Osama Hamad. You're in the wrong spot. You're supposed to be over there. I grabbed your spot. Yeah. Susanna Kelly. John Liu, L-I-U. Dean Wilmer, I think. Yeah, Wilmer. Mr. G, G-E. Jacob Harper. Mr. Vempati. Tim Fireisen. Catherine Pracknow. Oh, Fireisen. Eric Boyd. Mason Mandan. Jonathan Block. That Mandan or Block? That's what I thought. And Mr. Black, and somebody's always got to be last, Joel Thompson. So like that old joke, what do they call the fellow who finishes last in med school?
Doctor.
Okay, I think for the most part, as I said, you can see the stats on here. You did very well. Even the people on the low end, I think you're in good shape. And the key point now is to not totally devastate the final. The final is to be non-cumulative, so it'll only be on type checking and code generation. And again, there's some old exams to give you a flavor of what we're going to do. But there are oftentimes the flavor of, if we change CSX to have this or that particular component, how would you handle it? So examples, some old questions that say, we don't have for loops in our language, but we do have while loops, which aren't a heck of a lot different. So if you're going to do a for loop rather than a while loop, what all would have to change? That flavor of question and some others that we'll go over. But the key point now is to get the final component, the code generation part, going. And I had some comments on that. So what we're going to be doing is generating code for the Java virtual machine. Now, again, what does a virtual machine mean? That simply means that it's not an instruction set that works on manufactured chips. And there have been some experiments to put the JVM on a chip, but it turns out that it's really not as good an idea as you might think, because one of the advantages of a virtual machine is it works on any platform you want. These days, most PC, laptop-type systems use an Intel product, some version of the x86, maybe an i5 or an i7. And those are fairly limited in their architecture. But there are others, too. For a long while, Macs used PowerPC chips. Now they moved over very cleverly to x86s, because now what happens is Macs have a system called Parallels that you can actually bring up a Windows system on. So I'm sure many of you do that. If you have a Mac, you have not just a Mac, but you also have a Windows. And if you want, you can even bring up a Linux box if you care to. So it's a good flexible thing. But it turns out many palm tops and smartphones use ARM-type processors, which are rather different, but they can still handle Java. Because all you have to do is bring up the Java virtual machine. So as you're going to see, one of the cool things about doing the project this way is when you get your code generator working, you'll be able to run your CSX programs on almost any system that can handle Java, and that's just about anything. So if you want to run your own programs on your own machine, you can do it, and actually you can create your own language, and we suggested ways of changing that. So it turns out to be fairly positive. Now what's going to happen is we're going to be getting into JVM code, and what makes the Java virtual machine a tad different than other machines is it does not use registers. What it does instead is it has something that calls an operand stack. I'm going to explain later that it's really not as different as you might fear. But an operand stack always says the way we do a computation is we push values, typically either integers, 32 bits long, or references, which are essentially pointers, onto an operand stack. and execute instructions that manipulate the stack to load, store, compute, whatever it happens to be. So that's essentially the way our code's going to operate. It's going to turn out that we have several spots where we'll store data. The two most important ones will be static fields. That is, fields in a class declared static. Those are essentially global variables, and those will be accessed actually by a label. So it turns out if you name a field XYZ, the label will be very close, not quite identical, but very close to XYZ, and we'll be able to access that way. It also turns out that methods have local data. I talked about that last time in something called frames. A frame is essentially the allocation of data needed for a particular call to a method. And since methods can be recursive, it may be the case you have several frames for the same method on the stack. The top one is currently executing. The other ones are pending, waiting probably for a recursive call to end. And local data within a frame will be accessed by offsets. Turns out our offsets are not in terms of bytes, but in terms of operands, typically words. So that means a local variable might be given an offset 1 or 2 or 3. Think of them as simply being numbered, but actually they're implemented as offsets within a frame. So those are the places we'll find data, dynamically allocated on an operand stack. I'm not an operand stack, but a frame stack, or static as fields within a class. We'll have two different types we'll manipulate. We'll, for simplicity, use integers for both integers and Booleans with 0 and 1, or characters with 0 through 255 as being possible values. So that way we don't have to worry too much about types. All three of those CSX types are implemented on the JVM as integers. And we'll also have references for things that are dynamically allocated, typically arrays. Remember, in Java, arrays are allocated by a call to new. We'll actually have that implemented. And also strings are implemented as objects, and we have at least string literals. So we'll have those available. One of the questions people have had, and I certainly understand why, is what in the world am I going to generate for this or that? We have some very detailed notes. I've sent email out about some of those, and I have copies and more copies of various notes that give some detailed information and saying, hey, if you have to worry about translating a string literal or an integer literal or doing an addition, here's the typical JVM code that's recommended. But if you want to kind of look ahead or wonder what Java really does, it turns out there's a call that you can do at the command line level. Now, if you happen to have a Mac, you can always get down to the command line level by bringing up a terminal. Windows, I'm a little less familiar with, Windows 7. Does Windows 7 have some sort of command line where you can actually, say, run Java or Java C, or in this case, something called Java P? Okay, perhaps you or someone else could send something to the class in terms of Piazza, what they would need to do, if it's a simple thing. Okay. Osama, you're usually pretty good at that. Is that something you're familiar with? He's our systems wizard, or one of them. Where did he say? He's back there now. Okay, something like that. It's not anything you absolutely need to do, but it's simply a little trick that if you actually have a class generated by a standard Java compiler, you can ask it to deassemble it, and it'll actually show you the JVM instructions used. So the trick would be you create a little tiny method, and you're saying, how in the world do you handle arrays? Well, it would go ahead and say, show me how a sub I for an array with index I is handled, and you'd have it generate the code. My notes show you that, but if you want to see directly what a compiler does, that's a way of doing it. So that's available, and it would show you for a particular file. So if you have access to a command line sort of thing, it's fine, and certainly Mac, I've done that myself, so that works okay. We'll also be using something called Jasmine, and all these crazy names come up there, sorry. What Jasmine is essentially just an assembler that will take a source line file where you have one JVM instruction per line. That's sometimes called assembly language if you've taken computer science courses and done other assembly languages. Shortly, I'll show you a listing of generated assembly language that's simply generated as source lines. So that means for you generating code, it's pretty straightforward if you use Jasmine. Every time you want to generate an instruction, excuse me. Every time you want to generate an instruction, you simply do a print line to a particular file. We call it ASM file. That'll be the content of the translation. It'll be a source line file. It can be read and edited using any sort of text editor. And then what you would do is feed it into Jasmine. If Jasmine likes it, and if it doesn't, it'll certainly be pleased to tell you, it'll go ahead and generate a standard.class file, which then can be run using any Java system you want at all. So essentially, at the command line level, Java executes something. Something that's a form.class oftentimes is run routinely using Java, and that's essentially the Java JVM system interpreting the contents of a class file as a program. So the upshot is, if Java works on your system, you can be pretty sure that CSX will also work on your system. Just a matter of getting the details to get the right programs invoked. As you might imagine, we have this all set up on a build file. And certainly one fine way of doing it is to use a build file, and in that particular case, we have three different versions available for you to use. The simplest one is test. You use that when you simply bring over the skeleton for Project 5. That's the one that's running CSX Lite, but it's a full code generator. And if you run test, it'll do a full compile. It'll run through Jasmine, creating a class file, and actually execute the class file and allow you then to put input and output through the program. As you're getting your own program running, what you'll probably do is take your solution for 4 and simply bring in the classes that are needed additionally for Project 5. That'll certainly be the big class called Code Generating that has visit methods for all the various kinds of AST nodes that you happen to have and would say, well, this is the thing you'll execute if you're translating an interliteral node. This is what you're doing if you're doing and if-then construct, and so on and so forth. So we have two different versions. One is called test one. That's the one you use initially, because initially you probably won't be generating complete class files, something that Jasmine says this is a complete file that can generate a working class. And you don't have to. What you do is generate bits and pieces. Imagine that you may not have methods, which are one of the more complex things to be done, available initially. So all you'll done is when you stand in a method, you'll simply recursively call the code generator for fields and statements and let them generate those things that you've chosen to handle so far. So the upshot will be you'll take an image of a complete class file and effectively wipe out some of the lines, those that you haven't implemented yet. But the little bits and pieces that you have implemented, things like loads and stores, assignments, maybe addition, subtraction, those will be visible. And you'll be able to look at those. So test one will compile and show the generated code, which will probably be an incomplete input into Jasmine. At some point, you'll have added enough stuff that you're ready to let Jasmine go and do its thing. And at that level, you have test two, which will compile, generate the Jasmine, list it out for you, and then run it through Jasmine, creating a class file, which is then ready to be executed. If it's a situation where it does no input, and a lot of the test programs don't read input, because if they're complete, that means you don't have to worry about supplying arguments. There's some things you have to test that do have inputs, like reads, but a lot of things it simply says, do a while. So we'll set the parameters up, run the while, and here's the expected print that you'll have. And you can simply run the thing from compile through execution, look at the output and saying, is it equal to the expected output that the test program has listed probably in comments? And somebody said, what, did we have something like 99 or something test cases? Was there that many? 99 test cases on the wall, correct one, and you got 98 to go. Anyway, and yesterday we put in a zip file to make those easier to download. But that means you can simply do each one test a little bit of this or a little bit of that. And that's probably how the TA will test your final output. He'll have a number of fairly simple programs that simply say, I'm going to try arithmetic, or I'm going to try relational operators, or I'm going to try assignments, and not a lot of other things. It'll have to, of course, have print statements, because if print statements don't work, we won't be able to see the output and know what's going on. So that's something you'll want to implement fairly early. In my notes, that is actually handled fairly early. Okay, that's basically what I wanted to talk about just as an overview. So what I'm going to do is go back to the actual assignment that I handed out last time, namely assignment 5. Most of you have those, a few may not, so I should have a copy of some of those there. Okay, here it is. How many people need a copy of assignment 5, the code generator? Again, if I handed it out last time, you don't need another copy. So what I'm going to do on this is go to a couple of segments and talk in a little more detail about what it is you're asked to do, and then we'll actually get into the notes that I've handed out. I sent email over the last week about parts 1 and 2. Turns out there's actually 4 parts, not 3. So I also have copies of those just so you can be reading ahead. So my plan for today will be, we'll go into the assignment, I'll point a couple of things out, primarily looking a little bit at the generated code, explaining what it does. And then we'll get into some of the detailed notes about how to handle first simple things and then not so simple things that are included in the language. Okay, since you have copies in front of you, this is probably the right magnification. What this is page 2 of this assignment I've just been handing out. So page 1 essentially tells you that you have to have a new class called code generating. You create methods of that, and that takes a parameter that's of type printstream. That is a standard output text-oriented file that I'll call ASM file. So again, what's going to happen is you've already created the AST by calling the scanner and parser. You've already type-checked it. And by the way, we won't be doing any type incorrect programs from here on out. So even if parts of your type checkers were a little bit iffy here or there, it won't matter anymore. It's still important that your type checker go ahead and properly do the symbol table business, set this type in kind, because we certainly will be looking at that. But we'll only be worrying about correct programs. And what happens is on page 2, we have an example of a source program. And you probably should mark this down, because at some point in the next couple of weeks, your compiler should be able to handle this little source program. So what this is, as you probably can read it pretty well now, we have a class called simple, and it's got the usual main method. It's got a local variable named a of type int. It reads into a and then prints out the answer 2a plus 1 and puts in a new line. So it does printing of strings and integers and characters. And that's a little bit of everything. And what's going to happen is here's what a correct program would be translated into. Good, and I can just about get the whole thing on the slide, and that's fairly sharp. So what's going to happen is this is what Jasmine is going to generate, but you won't be generating it all at once. Some parts will be generated in one place and others in others. In particular, anything that begins with a dot is not an instruction, but rather a command to Jasmine to give it some parameter information or some structure information. So we're generating a class, and the very first line that then says dot class says, I'm creating a class of type public. All our classes are going to be public. They could be private, but that's fancier and unnecessary. And we chose to call the class simple. How do I know that? Well, because the source said my class name is simple, so I grabbed that string and plugged it in as saying, I want you to generate me a class that's public access and is named simple. The stuff with the semicolon following it are comments. They don't need to be generated, but here's a little trick that you want to know about and think about. As you're generating code, there's no reason why you can't generate comments that give information about something about that code. For example, if you're just generating part of the instruction, part of the method, you could put the line number that this source line number that this line of code corresponds to. Remember, the source line number is in the AST node. We put that in way back when. We use it for error messages, but we can also use it for commentary. So if, for example, you're generating a load or a store, a push or a pop, you could show the line number that you think it's associated with, just so that when you're saying, well, what the hey did that come from? Okay, this came from that line, that came from another line. And if you're wondering why something is where it is, you'd have that information. As long as you generate a semicolon, you can write anything you want there, and it'll be ignored by Jasmine. So it can be useful for you as debugging information. You don't necessarily need to do it immediately, but keep that in mind. Whenever you generate something, what does it mean to generate an instruction? All it means is you ran a print. And every time I say generate this or generate that, you'll essentially do a print line to the ASM file, so asmfile.println, that will contain some things will be constant. So for example, the dot class public is constant, so that'll just be a string. The simple will be a variable obtained by looking at the CSX node, the class node, I should say, and grabbing the class name as a string and putting it in there. You then see that's all you would need to do there. The semicolon whatever is just my commentary for your reading. But again, you could add information if you cared to for debugging, saying this is for this line or this has to do with this symbolic value or whatever. Don't have to do it, but it's a nice idea if you're debugging and you're getting a little bit lost as to where things are coming from. The next line begins with a dot also. And it turns out that classes, remember, have a class structure. And all classes are child or grandchild or great-grandchild of the great original class called object. So in the beginning, there was object. And all creatures were created as sub-creatures of object. So it says, my superclass, that is my parent class, as it's called, is Java. Now, normally, in packages, you use a dot. But in this case, they use slashes to separate the components in the assembler. So it says, in this case, when you see a slash, read that as in Java source would be a dot. So it says java.lang.object, which is the package that contains the magic object that's the parent of all classes. So you're saying I'm simply a direct ancestor, a direct child of object. It's got to be in there. This is pure boilerplate. That means all your translations will always have that line in the same spot. So it's just a print line of a constant string that contains this stuff. It's got to be there, but it's easy to do. Yes. Yes.
So it's boilerplate text that they put in that is required to
know. Right. Well, normally in Java, you would say that you might have a class that extends an existing class, and then you'd say your parent. So you could have a class that extends some sort of print class. You're adding stuff. So that's the generality of it, but everybody has to dive in there because at some points, if it's looking up where to find a method, if you don't have that method, it'll say, I'm going to go to your parent. And some of the basic classes, basic methods, like toString, if nothing else, you inherit it from object. The toString in object is pretty poor, but it's there. And so that means that you're sure to find a match. So we're doing in there just so that we don't break the rules. If we break the rules, they may break us, and don't like that. So the thing with a semicolon says we have a little bit of a conundrum. I've made all this business about the fact that we're going to be standard Java. But we're not standard Java. In standard Java, you have a main method you start with that's void, but it takes not a null parameter list, but rather an array of strings. It does that so you can have arguments on a command line passed to the program. But we don't have that. We don't really have arrays of strings, so why would we expect a user to give an array of something we don't allow arrays of? So what we did here is we have a little bit of amounts to a workaround. Namely, we're going to give Java what it wants, and what it wants is a method that says, I'm a public static method. How do I return void? Well, it turns out in their type signatures, we talked about this previously, that Mr. Carlson, I believe, used type signatures. And in this case, the result type signature comes at the right end rather than the left. So this V at the very right end is for void. And it says, it takes main takes, well, what, an array. Well, in their crazy type signature language, I guess it's not so crazy, the square bracket, the left square bracket says, I'm an array of. So it says, I'm an array of. Well, in this case, it's a class that exists in some library. So it turns out in their language L, and I'm not quite sure whether they use L, but starting with L and ending with a semicolon, I can have a path name that says where to find the class object that I want to have an array of. So it says I'm going to be an array of java.lang.string, and the semicolon just ends it because that's variable length. So it says I'm going to take an array of strings as my parameter. That's what Java expects. We're going to give it to it. But what we're going to do in there is simply say, well, we have a simpler definition of main. And remember, we can overload methods. You've spent a lot of time in assignment 4 figuring out how to overload methods. Well, finally, we're going to get some benefit out of it. We're going to say, we're going to expect the user in CSX has provided a simpler kind of main. It's still going to be something that returns void. but it's going to be something that's called main. It's in our class simple. So simple.main is going to have a method of no arguments, hence the empty parentheses that returns void. And what I want the Java main to do is simply call the user-defined main. This may look a little bit ugly, but it's a way to patch over the fact that Java wants one thing and CSX wants another, so we'll have a compromise. And I'm sure if you have all that when you decide to go and rent a movie or go to see a movie with your partner. You have your set of movies, your partner has his or her set of movies, and the intersection is so minuscule that it usually gets burned out in the first couple of weeks. So what you end up having to do is satisfy both parties, and of course the standard way of doing that is satisfy neither party. You go and see a nice Disney movie or something, Bambi, was it Bambi Meets Godzilla or something like that. That's one of the great movies. And it actually does exist, if you've ever seen it. It's not a very long movie, but it does exist. So in this case, you call a compromise thing that says, okay, Java wants main with one parameters, we want main with another, so we'll simply call it. And having return from the user's main, we'll do a return. That return means exactly what you would expect it to. One of the nice things about Java JVM is that many instructions are very simple cognates of what you find in Java. So in this particular case, return means return. We have something with a dot in front of it. And this case is a little technical thing, but essentially we have to give a heads up to the Java system on how deep the operand stack is going to be. In this case, 2 is sufficient, and this is saying, oh, by the way, the operand stack will need no more than 2 elements. That's because we didn't use it very much. We just did a call. And then the end method says, this is the end of the text of the method I'm currently opening. So dot method and dot end method match. And you can always draw like a little bracket saying it starts in one spot and ends in another. Let's see how we're doing on time, because I got some more to get into. Yeah, we just got a couple of minutes, and that's not quite enough to get through the rest of this. So why don't we take a break now, and a couple of minutes before 4:45, we'll resume talking you through what this code is generating, and then we'll actually go to the code generation notes and tell you how to start generating some of this stuff. So we'll see you in about 15 minutes, and I'll kill the timer, which is just getting ready to kill me.